This is Where Did the Road Go? Our aim is to explore the fringe, to be true skeptics and question openly, to investigate the paranormal, bring light to the dark corners of history, and give a voice to the shunned of science. We deal in mystery and the important questions that these subjects bring to light. What is reality? Who are we? And why are we here? Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com for a full show archive, links to all our social media, upcoming schedule, and much, much more. Now, join your host Soraya on this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
So tonight, I am airing part one of a two-part interview with David Politis. We're going to be talking about his new book, Missing 411, A Sobering Coincidence. This is a different turn in the Missing 411 series, as you're about to hear. And in these next two parts, we will discuss a number of different cases. However, if you're going to get a real feel for what's going on here, you really need to read the book. No interview is going to give you the same amount of information as the Missing 411 books themselves. And when you read the book, you can really see the patterns David is talking about. It becomes crystal clear as you move through case after case that gives you the same points. It's dark, it's creepy, and whatever it is, it's not going anywhere. These aren't just scary campfire stories. These are real people who died in mysterious ways, and there's no good explanation to what happened to them. David has done an amazing amount of work here, collecting these cases, correlating them based on certain points, certain pieces of evidence that show up again and again. There are no simple answers here. Sit back and listen and, try to wrap your brain around it, because I know I can't. All right, David, welcome back to the show.
Well, thanks a million, Soraya. It's always great to be here.
And last time I had you on, we were talking about your documentary, and you definitely got that funded.
Well, it was thanks to you and all the supporters out there who pitched in, and we were very fortunate to get well above our minimum target, and we're very, very grateful for the support.
Do you have a timetable on when you're going to be putting that out by any chance?
Well, we're targeting late spring and summer to do film festivals, and according to their rules, we can't release anything before we submit to a film festival.
Right.
So we got to wait, and my guess is it'll probably be somewhere around 10 to 12 months before you actually see anything about what we've done.
But you're going to be able to do a little more than you planned, though, aren't you?
Oh, we've already been talking about doing some on-screen animation work that we weren't going to be able to do before, so this is good.
Awesome. All right, and then right on top of that, you have released a brand new book.
Yeah, I promised people on Facebook there were going to be a series of announcements over the next several months, and this is the next one, and it has to do with Missing 411. We stay on the same theme, but as I say, there's another spoke in the wheel.
Yeah. You call this one a sobering coincidence.
Yep.
And you go in a very different direction here as you're looking at more urban areas, but you're still looking for specific patterns. And if anyone doesn't get that, you're not just following random missing people and reporting on them. You're looking for very specific patterns, very certain things in these cases that replicate in other cases. It's not just a matter of someone going missing.
So we call them profile points. And it is exactly, some people have said, Politis is just cherry picking reports and looking for specific elements. That's exactly what we're doing.
Right.
We are looking for patterns within missing people cases. And if those elements that exist show themselves in a case, we're interested. And as an example, one of them is they bring a canine out and the canine can't find any scent of where the victim went. That's one of the profile points that continues to show up. And I don't care what kind of missing person case it is, at this point we're going to be looking at it if that exists.
Okay, and Why did you turn toward these more urban accounts?
Well, I've got to give some credit to George Knapp. I was doing a show with him a couple years ago, and he said, you know, I think you're going to find your way to the city one of these days. And he goes, I realize that's going to be a tougher case to make without people being able to say, oh, this happened or that happened, like you can in the woods. But he goes, I just think you're headed that way. And those kind of people need to say something every once in a while for us to keep our eyes wide open and not get tunnel vision on what we're doing. And it did. It forced us to keep our eyes open and look at a broader spectrum. And I was reading an article one day about a college kid who disappeared. They bring canines in, the canines walk in circles, and they can't find the scent. And right away, I started paying attention. And then other elements of what we've identified were showing up, and we said, yeah, maybe there's something to these college kids that are disappearing. And I'd written about college-age students who had disappeared on campuses in the past under strange circumstances. But this was a little different in that the 100-plus cases in this book are almost cookie cutters of each other.
Yeah. Yeah, and some of this has been covered under the title The Smiley Face Murders.
Correct. Now, it's a series of detectives. Kevin Gannon from New York City, a retired homicide detective and missing persons investigator. Early in his career, he came across a missing persons case, and Dan, the guy was sharp. Where a lot of missing persons detectives would find a body in the water, write the report, go home and forget it, Gannon actually spent a lot of time analyzing where the body was found, how it was found, the distance it was found, why it wasn't wearing certain clothing. And he put his mind to it, and he uncovered some things that were monumental. Now, the smiling face part of it, I don't buy into that part of it, but what Gannon did in proving through forensics that those bodies weren't in the water as long as people said was sort of our entry point. Namely, that the bodies are found without clothing or without shoes, which matches what we've been doing. Canines can't track the body or the person from where they were last seen to the water. Sometimes there's no relationship, and there's no tracks, there's nothing between where they disappeared and the water, and there had to have been in logical terms. And then when we expand that out and we say, okay, if our profile points fit what they're doing, then it should follow that this is happening in other countries. And we followed the path, and that's exactly what happened. We have cases in Spain, in the UK, and that fit exactly with what we're talking about that's happening here in the United States and Canada. And in the same way it happened in the Missing 411 books before, it's happening exactly here.
Now, where did the smiley face thing come from? Wasn't there like a smiley face near where some of the bodies were found or something like that?
That's what they said, yeah.
Yeah, okay. I knew people were starting to move away from that idea and realizing it was probably just a coincidence.
Yeah, probably.
What you have, though, is although most of these are very cookie cutter, there are some that kind of stand out a little bit, but the main points are still there. Go on.
I think that's I'm glad you were able to see that by reading it, because it has to be evident to the reader that this all is one consistent criminal occurrence that's been happening for years. Now, in the first three or four books, it kind of looked like a lot of things could be happening. Now, when you put the forensics to these cases, there can be no doubt that a crime's occurring. When a person disappears on one date, they find their body in the river 50 days later, and the coroner and the medical examiners come back and say, well, yeah, but the body wasn't in the river all those times for all those dates.
Yeah. And I still think that there could be multiple explanations for what you're seeing, but there is definitely a sort of a malicious pattern there as well. There is something, in a sense, victimizing these people.
I don't think there's any doubt now.
In the earlier books, you could go a couple of different ways, but yeah, with this book, it's hard to get away from that.
And in the earlier books, when I said that bodies were found in areas previously searched, that continues on here. In this instance, what's happened is that the water has given us evidence that land couldn't give us. the water does certain things to the body at an exact pace that can't be misinterpreted. Whereas on land, there's a lot of variables, humidity, rain, snow, animal predation, et cetera, et cetera. In the water, there's an exact science that's known about how fast a body will deteriorate, skin maceration, loss of hair. All these things happen at a certain time frame, and you know exactly how long the body's been in. Well, if one of the male college students disappears on January 1st, he's found 50 days later, and he still has rigor mortis in his body, you know that that person hasn't been dead for more than a couple days. It's just fact.
Right. And also the element, what's it called, the date rape drug being found in some of these cases.
GHB.
Yeah, and that is not something you find in high levels in the body naturally.
Correct. In low levels, you do. In high levels, you don't. What's interesting is that there's a toxicological screening that the bodies go through at the coroner's office. GHB is not one of those standard screening drugs that they're looking for. And the fascinating part of that is what GHB does to the body when you take it is it makes you almost paralyzed, but you're awake and you know what's happening. So if you somebody gave you GHB or you somehow ingested GHB, say there's some kind of aerosol way to deliver it, and you get put in a river, you're not going to be able to fight back. You're going to drown. And in all of these cases, or in a vast majority of them, drowning is a possibility in how they died. And the coroners don't test for GHB. But son of a gun, some of them realized something was really going on, and they started to test, and they started to find it. Now, the million-dollar question is, how did these people get GHB into their system at such high levels, when in reality they were around friends and things, and then boom, they're gone? Who knows how they got it?
Yeah, and we'll get into some of the cases here where you can kind of tell that somebody just disappeared.
Right.
But we'll get on to those in a little bit later. Why don't we go through, you have a section here on key cases, and these are good, solid examples of the pattern you're talking about. And this first one comes from north of where we are here in New York State in Canton. And his name was Adam Falcon.
Yeah, January 13th, 2004, about 1:38 in the morning, 20 years old, Adam Falcon. He went to St. Lawrence University. They have about 2,500 students. The big majors there, economics and biology. He's a really popular kid. He played competitive soccer for St. Lawrence. And he taught soccer during the summer. He's described as like Mr. Personality, easygoing, polite, loved kids. Well, it turns out that on the 12th of November, he got hurt at practice, and he couldn't play. And he didn't play. But on the night of the 12th, he had two bowls of spaghetti before he attended a St. Lawrence hockey game in town. And at about 9:15, the game was over. He left with some friends, and they went to a party at a place called the Don Eaton Dormitory on campus. He hung around there for about 45 minutes, and then he and some buddies went to a local coffee house to listen to some music. They left at about 11. At 11:30, his card access at the university showed him returning to that dorm party. At 12:30 a.m. on November 13th, just a couple hours or an hour later, he leaves that dorm, and he went to downtown Canton to a place called the TikTok Bar on Hodgkin Street, just off of Main Street. And at 1:38, witnesses put him going out the back door of the bar, and he's never seen again alive. And what happened was is the next day they had a soccer game, and he had responsibilities even though he was injured, and he didn't report to the game. Nobody saw him. At 10 p.m. that night, they reported him as a missing person. This is one of those things in Canton at the time, the whole town pitched in, and I mean all the sports teams. Helicopters came in, planes, the soccer team and other athletic teams participated in the search, forest rangers, volunteers, and the New York State dive team came in and spent their time in the river looking for any evidence of anybody in the river. On the 18th, an article stated that 30 divers searched the river in town, and the dive master made a special statement that By going into the river, it eliminates any possibility that Adam's in the water. So they eliminated that. Now, they just 4 or 5 hours later, after that statement came out, some police officers in town were searching in an area almost in the middle of town, and they found Adam's baseball cap and his cell phone in an opposite direction of the river from the bar, sitting on a pile of leaves. Now, what's fascinating about this is that the report stated that there was none of his scent found on the cell phone or the baseball cap. And on a baseball cap, you should have really heavy scent. And it was found between two buildings, behind a fence line, on a pile of leaves. And I say in the book, I commend the police officers in finding this, because it was in a place you would never, ever think to look. It was almost like it could have been dropped in or thrown over the way it landed. So on November 19th, almost at the end of the day, 4:55 p.m., behind the Knights of Columbus Hall, in a 7-foot-deep hole, searchers are prodding around, and they find Adam's body. Now, he had no pants, he had his boxers on, and he had his shoes on. And the police couldn't explain how his pants were off, and his shoes were on, and his boxers were on. And his pants were later found 80 feet downstream. And the witnesses said that they were sure searchers had searched that hole many times in the previous days and found nothing. And this is a real slow-moving river, 2 to 3 miles per hour, no acceleration to it at all. Canines that were searching the city for Adam never went anywhere near the water. So they're stumped. Now, on the 13th at 1:38, you fast forward 5 days later, and Adam's pulled out of the river. And the coroner stated that he had rigor mortis that was identifiable, and that he should have been out of rigor mortis being gone for 5 days, because rigor mortis enters, that's the stiffening of the muscles, and that enters the body 2 to 4 hours after death, and it leaves the body at 24 to 36 hours after death. So there is no way Adam should have had any rigor mortis in his system if he died the night or the early morning that he disappeared. And the coroner stated that the rigor mortis was moderate, meaning that he wasn't going into it or coming out of it. He was in the middle of it, which meant that he had to have died sometime on the 16th, 3 days after he disappeared on the 13th. Now, lividity is the settling of blood in your body after death. So if you're laying on your back, the blood would settle in your buttocks and in your shoulders, and it starts 30 minutes after you die, and it stays in a fixed position 12 hours after you die. Now, the coroner stated that on Adam's body, the lividity was found in several different locations, which is puzzling. Some people call it the washing machine effect, that if you're in a river and you're getting tossed over and over and over again, that you could have this effect. But the river moved so slowly that didn't make sense. And the real most puzzling thing is that Adam's body was supposedly, everyone believed initially, in that river for 5 days. So decomposition should have been happening, and it should have been fairly well advanced at this point. Yet his body was so pristine, they had an open casket at the funeral. Now, Kevin Gannon and his partner Gilbertson, who is a professor, believe Adam was taken, held for 3 days, and dumped in the river to die. Now, the coroner ruled that it was accidental drowning with hypothermia. Adam's father said in an interview that when he went in to get the answers about what happened to his son, he was insulted by the lack of facts and the way he was treated. It was almost as though they were treating him like he was stupid, and they couldn't really explain what happened. And then another coroner stated that he believed Adam had to have been unconscious when he entered the river. Two other medical examiners reviewed the coroner's findings who initially did it. One coroner stated that Adam didn't even drown, and another said that the cause of death was inconclusive. Now, if I presented this case to you or a group of students, everyone would say, well, yeah, that's pretty interesting. That's pretty weird. But, you know, a lot of weird things happen in life, and maybe this did. But after you read the facts of this case, and I present to you other cases that have almost identical facts, how can this be happening?
Yeah. Yeah, and that's the thing. If it was just one case, okay, that would be, in a way, dismissible because you didn't see it replicated anywhere. And maybe someone got something wrong or something very weird happened in that one case. But when you're seeing it repeat over and over, it's either saying we don't understand or it's deliberate.
Yeah, and I don't see... Because these things about your body are so cut and dry, I don't see how there are many other explanations other than, especially when you look at the bulk of these cases on the whole, these young men were not dead the night that they went missing. They weren't in the water the night they went missing. And if you read my previous books, how did Adam Falcon's pants come off and his shoes are on?
Yeah, that. It just, so every aspect of this, you know, where his stuff was found, everything was just bizarre. Now, in a lot of these cases, the people who disappear were last seen drunk. And when they're found, they still have a high alcohol content in their body. But like in this case, you know, where he had only died recently, shouldn't the alcohol have gotten out of their systems before the point they were found?
You would think that would be the case. But there's another case in the books where a guy was leaving the bar and he's stopped by two police officers. And he's underage. And the police officers interview him and he's not drunk. Two guys interview him. And they end up issuing him a series of citations for being underage in a bar and this and that. He had been drinking, but he wasn't intoxicated. So he disappears under similar circumstances to Adams. And he's found days later. And there's no way he could have been in the river for the entire time either. Yet his blood alcohol level was through the roof. And the police officers even said, we are baffled by how he got the alcohol in his system, because the town was shut down at the time and the bars were closed when he left. And where the police officers released him versus where he supposedly went in the river and where he was supposedly found, it almost indicated that he left the police officers, disappeared, showed up days later in a river downstream in a place he shouldn't have been. So it's almost as though these people are somehow getting the alcohol into their system or getting the drugs into their system in some way we don't understand.
Or someone is making sure it's there before they die in order to cover up what's really going on.
Exactly.
Because they know people will say, well, he was drunk and wandered into the river.
You know, another individual used this term, and I'm going to use it every time I'm in an interview. It's called plausible deniability. And in all of the cases that I present, it's easy to go to that place in your mind and say, well, you know, it's plausible that this happened or that happened. Or like you said, in these cases, they were drunk and they're just stupid kids and they fell in the water. And, you know, that's the safe place in your mind to go. Or in the other books, you know, they were hikers and they made a bad decision and they walked into infinity and they fell off a cliff and they died.
Right.
So that's a plausible deniability factor. And if you don't invest in truly understanding what's happening here, that's where you're going to go.
Sure. It's the easy out.
Exactly.
Another key case you had in there, and I'm going to say the kid's name last name wrong, but it's Todd Guibe or Geib?
I think it's Guibe.
Guibe, okay. And this one has another element into it, which you have in a few of these cases, which is he was on the cell phone when he disappeared.
And there's a few cases like that I have in the book that are pretty scary with the consequences. And I mean, there's a handful where the people were on the phone with somebody, and it's almost as though they saw something or something happened to them. They get a few words out, and boom, they're gone.
Yeah.
Now, in Todd's case, June 11th, 05, 1 a.m., Casanova, Michigan, It's about 25 miles north of Grand Rapids. And this area is an established cluster, geographical cluster area that we have on our map for missing people, kind of the area of Weber and Ludington, Michigan. But Guy knew Casanova like the back of his hand. He was an outdoorsman, trophy fisherman, deer hunting, played basketball, baseball in school. He was described as having a very dry sense of humor, strongly religious ties, Protestant and Catholic. And the only vice people said he really had was smoking. Now, I'll say this, that there seems to be a tie-in between German people and these disappearances. And I don't understand it, and I'm not saying it's an overwhelming tie-in at this point, but there seems to be something there. And Todd had strong family ties as well, and his parents lived 5 miles away in Ravenna. Well, on June 11th, 05, at about 6 to 6:30, he was at his parents' house. He had some dinner, and he left, and he went back home, and he lived with his cousin. They spoke briefly, and then they drove at 7:30 to a local bar, met some friends for drinks. At 9:30, Todd left the bar, walked on foot to a local party, an annual party that's held in this orchard. A couple kegs, bonfire, 50 people. It's just a fun thing to do in the middle of a field. And at about 12 a.m., Todd told people he was tired and he was going to walk to his house. And I'll stop you there. When you read the book, you're gonna see that the people that disappear either are going to say they don't feel good or they're tired, and they separate themselves from people in many of these incidents. And Todd, for some reason, said he was tired and was leaving. Well, he knew this area like the back of his hand. He spent so much time here. On his way from that location to his house, he made 4 phone calls between 12:45 and 1 a.m. At 12:47, he called a friend and said he was in a field, and the call dropped. Friend called back, and he thought he heard heavy breathing or wind. Another call said he was having trouble breathing and was in a field, and it dropped. Now, what's interesting is that in my other books, just north of this location, I wrote a story about a guy named Cullen Finnerty who was an NFL football player, and he was fishing, and during that time he was fishing, he called his wife, heavy breathing, said that he thought he was being followed by some big guys, and he was scared, and they ended up finding him dead in a field. Now, Todd, what's fascinating is that right after I did a coast-to-coast interview, and I explained that there's a couple of these cases where there's heavy breathing and wind, somebody said, well, what happens if he was pulled up fast up into the air, and that wind was the wind in the phone because of the acceleration going up into the sky?
Huh.
Kind of an interesting angle when you consider that they bring in canines and they don't pick up any scent.
Yeah.
Well, so he disappears, and almost immediately a search starts because he was supposed to be at a family event the next day. And there were some rumors that there was some altercation between Todd and some other people. That was false. On June 13th, 100 searchers combed the area. Canines are brought in, helicopters. No scent is found by the canines. All the swamps, lakes in the area were searched. His residence was on the west side of Half Moon Lake, east side of Highway 37, and the party was on the west side of the road. Now, they continue to search, and there's a small body of water on the west side of the highway called Ovid Hall Lake. It's about 1,000 feet long, and it's narrow. There's no road that goes to it. It's not easily accessible, but some locals do fish it. Now, people did fish the lake on May 17th through the 18th. And they were using fish finders and underwater radar to look at the bottom of the water and scan the bottom. And they went through the whole lake, the witnesses said, and saw nothing. Now, July 2nd at 5 p.m., long after Todd disappeared, a husband and wife are walking along the lake, and they're walking down to it, and they see something really odd in the water. They describe it as protruding from the water. They go down, and it's Todd's body. And the witness told the police it was floating like a bobber. Now, Todd's hat, his cell phone, and one shoe were missing. And he had been missing for 21 days. Now, once you know, understand the forensics of a body, men die, and they always, always, always float face down in the water based on our body composition. Women tend to float face up. Todd's sticking up out of the water, floating like a bobber, which makes no sense at all under any conditions. Now, people said that the location had been searched many times. He was found in the opposite direction. If he was traveling from the party to his house, he was on the opposite side of the party, way in the opposite direction. And in a location that had a low probability that he would have been, but they searched it anyhow. Now, when the on-scene coroner gets there and pulls the body out, he writes down in his paperwork as the circumstances are suspicious. So right away, they're not thinking that this is a drowning. Now, there's no rigor in the body. There's no ice in the lake to force the body up. They couldn't determine any lividity in the body, which makes absolutely no sense because it's in a pond or small lake with no current. They said decomposition was intermediate to moderate. He had hair in his head. He had swelling around his eyelids. They couldn't determine the color of the iris. But the body, for being in the water for 21 days, was described as pristine. Doesn't make sense. His blood alcohol level was determined to be 0.12. Long time ago, the blood alcohol level for driving under the influence in most states was 0.10, so he wasn't stumbling drunk. Toxicology tests determined that there was something called contanine, which is a byproduct of smoking. And he had some drugs in his system that were depression-oriented drugs. And Todd never took any drugs, and he wasn't under any depressed state. And they couldn't determine, no one could determine how these got in his system. Now, how he died, or how and the circumstances he got in the water were listed by the coroner as undetermined, but they thought he drowned. But there was no water found in his lungs. So right there, there's some unusual parts to this story, but they bring in a secondary autopsy from a famous doctor named Cyril Wecht. He determined that Todd was dead or unconscious when he entered the water. He determined that photos of the body that were taken, I mean, they took photos of the body after he'd come out in an autopsy. They took it to a medical conference, and they showed it to the attendees, which were all medical examiners. And it was the unanimous opinion that the body had not been in the water 20-plus days. And it was the opinion that he was held somewhere for 15 to 18 days and then placed in the water. And the parents and everyone involved tried to get the Michigan State Police, who had this case, to change the cause of death from drowning to murder, and they wouldn't touch it.
So with the phone call, I mean, that's really interesting. I hadn't really considered that the wind sound might be movement. There are a couple other cases in this book, one where the guy says, beep, and then just that was the last you heard of him. And another one where, if I remember right, the person was yelling for help and sounding like they were being pulled away from the phone.
Right. There's a case in Minnesota where the guy's walking away. He's talking to a girl, and the girl says, "What's going on?" And he says, "Oh, my God, where are you?" And then the phone goes dead. Another time, there's a case where a guy's at a Boston Bruins game. He's talking to his girlfriend on the phone. He goes, "You know, I think my phone's going to go dead." She's around the corner, turns the corner. The phone's dead. She can't see, and he was supposed to be right there. He's not there. He's found days later in a river nearby, and his phone is found smashed into a million pieces nearby.
Right. And that's one of the cases I wanted to talk about, too, because of that.
Yeah, it's the phone going dead, the people separated from the phone, seems to be a common occurrence.
And one of the other things that seems to be a common occurrence is that so many of the people are found in the opposite direction that they were last seen going.
Pretty unusual. especially in a case like Todd's, where the guy knew the area by the back of his hand, and to end up so convoluted in the water makes zero sense.
Yeah. And of course, one of the other common things is that people are found in areas that are previously searched, which is something that is extremely common in your previous books as well, out in the national parks.
And, you know, I say this all the time, and it's probably a good time to say it again. This isn't implying that the search people missed the body or they did a bad job and they weren't conscientious. I think all the evidence points to, when you get the number of cases that I've accounted for where this has happened, it points in those cases that the people probably weren't there. Now, when you're talking about water cases, we can prove the people weren't there.
Right, right, because you have the forensic evidence behind it.
Correct.
So let's look at the case of Joseph Grunzel, and this was someone who was actually in the military.
Yeah, and this is a Canada case, and it's around the Great Lakes, and I said in my last Missing 411 book that we established a cluster zone that completely surrounds the Great Lakes. And this is one of those cases that happened right on a Great Lake in Canada. Absolutely a straight arrow kid, 21 years old, October 22nd, 2003, Kingston, Ontario, Canada. He's at the Royal Canadian Military Academy. Canada only has one college-level military academy, and this is it. And the best of the best in Canada go there. It's at the far northeast end of Lake Ontario, 160 miles southwest of Montreal. And, I mean, they have the brightest of the best there. Well, Grozel was one of them. On October 22nd, he was in his junior year, and he was just elected to the most prestigious position you could have in that year, and that was squadron leader. And it was a huge position for any cadet. He played on the academy's basketball team. He was described as everybody, a smart, polite, mature, an absolute stellar individual. Now, I'll stop you there. And when I was a police officer, I came across in the middle of the night when I was on patrol, sometimes the credence of the world, the underprivileged, the alcoholics, the drug addicts, the people that would be sleeping in doorways, intoxicated, under the influence, etc. And when you take what I've described here in the books and you apply it to normal, everyday municipality, you would expect that some of these victims were of that level in society, the criminals, the drug addicts, the stone-cold alcoholics that made their way into this river system and drowned, or into a pond or into a lake. And in writing all about this, there isn't one of those cases.
Yeah.
And in my books, I've described that there's both ends of that intellectual spectrum. There's people that are just the brightest of the bright, the physicians, the physicists, the people that are in college that have disappeared. On that other end, you have people with brain disease, autism, dementia, that have also disappeared. But you would expect that some of these people would be of the lower level in society that fell in the river and drowned. But that's not what's happening here. The people I've described in the books, many times I wrote a story, and at the end I had tears in my eyes because it reminded me of my own kids. And to think that these people ended up in a water makes no sense. And if you followed logic, it would say that a cross-section of society should end up in that position, not just right. The best of the best. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, on October 22nd, 2003, Joe's in his dorm room working on a school paper. His girlfriend, a long-term girlfriend, is in the room studying a law class. And at 1 a.m., she falls asleep. Joe's on the computer. She wakes up at 5:30 a.m. He's missing. His cell phone, watch, and wallet in the room. Now, there you go. Separation of person from cell phone. How many 21-year-old guys walk out of a room for a couple hours and don't take their wallet and their cell phone?
Yeah.
At 6 a.m., she leaves the room. He still hasn't seen Joe, and periodically checked the room during the day. At about 4:30 p.m., he had basketball practice, so she goes to practice, and he wasn't there. And she told the coach, hey, something's wrong. They file a missing persons report. So this happens on military property, and it belongs to the military, and they originally take over the search of the grounds, the water areas, the buildings, and they confiscated his computer and went through that, thinking that he's on the computer. Maybe he's communicating with somebody. He went out and met with some foul play. It didn't happen. And then they started to work with the Kingston, Ontario Police, the Provincial Police, and the National Investigative Service of the military. And everybody is working to find this kid. Well, the academy sits on the peninsula of the Cataraqui River at the west end of Lake Ontario, kind of where the river flows into the lake. On the 13th of November, almost 3 weeks later, his body's found in the river. And the coroners are unable to determine the cause of death. There are very few details released about his body. But almost a year later, his body is exhumed, and they do a secondary autopsy. They confirm to the public there were no drugs or alcohol in his system, which isn't a surprise because he was just a standout, straight arrow kid. Again, a secondary autopsy refers an undetermined cause of death. Grozel's parents were interviewed, and his parents said his death was neither an accident nor suicide. And I think those are revealing, and you got to listen to that and think that through. Now, this is a weird set of circumstances, but 40 miles west of that academy is the Canadian Forces base called Trenton. And there was a colonel there named Russell Williams, who was the commander of the 8th Wing at the base, from August of 03 to June of 04. There was some innuendo because the colonel was charged with murdering two people. And there was some innuendo that he may have been involved in Joe's murder and they didn't want anything involved in it. Well, an autopsy proved that there was nothing done to the body that would remotely be a homicide per se.
Right.
But Joe's body was in the river, and the location it was found in after that number of days would indicate that his body would have had to have been dumped in the river miles and miles upstream to end up where it did when it was found. Now, the things to think about is that he left his cell phone behind. What pulled him from that room? Why did he leave when his girlfriend was there asleep? How many 21-year-olds go anywhere without their cell phone? One coroner stated that Joe's body was consistent with being in the water for 1 to 2 weeks. He was missing October 22nd, found November 13th, 21 days or 3 weeks missing. I think it's pretty evident that he wasn't in the water the whole time again. Based on where he was found in the river, and based on his body composition and decomposition factors found at the time.
Are you familiar with the disappearance of a trucker named Devin Williams?
I don't think so.
Okay. While we were talking this, it reminded me of this. Steph Young, who I've had on the show a few times, also collects strange disappearance stories. She's not doing them in a pattern whatsoever. She's just looking at different odd things that have happened. And Devin Williams he was a long-distance trucker. He drove his truck into the National Forest area of Buck Springs, and that is in, it doesn't say where it is. Well, anyway, his truck eventually got stuck on a dirt road. He disembarked and walked away from the truck. Hikers nearby were witness to this odd, erratic behavior. They asked him why he drove his truck there, and he pointed to the truck and said, "I didn't. They did it." They told how he was barefoot and seemed disoriented as he talked to a tree. That was the last time anyone saw him. Then he vanished without a trace. They found his bones some time later, but canines couldn't find a track or anything else. And it sounds very similar to the patterns that you're describing. And it's almost like something is affecting these people. in such a way, like it's not quite schizophrenic, but something is getting into their heads.
Well, one of the things in the stories that I think can be said is at the time there's separation between people, the victim and their friends. The people aren't aware of that separation point.
Yeah.
Now, in Grozel's case, the girlfriend says she fell asleep. In other cases that I talk about in the book, the people are together in a bar, and one second their friends are there, and the next second they're gone, and nobody ever sees them leave. In other cases, there's closed-circuit television coverage of the entrances and exits, and there's no evidence that they did leave, and we'll talk about something like that later. But there, at that separation point, there is no witness, which is a strange fact.
Well, even in the other books, you have cases where, you know, the person last in line or first in line disappears when they're out of sight, even if they're only out of sight for a moment.
Correct.
So you're again getting that pattern, but there are numerous cases in all these books where it seems like somebody sees something or gets distracted by something. Or in this case of Joe here, you know, it's like he just suddenly got up and walked out of his room and disappeared.
Now, in this case, somebody brought this up to me already and said, well, Dave, you know, a lot of times under the work of John Mack, he talks about people in a bedroom and one person can be awake and they can't wake up the other person.
Mm-hmm.
And they claim that they're removed from the room somehow.
Right.
So in that circumstances, if you read Mack's work, that could have been the scenario here. We don't know.
That's very true. That's very true. Of course, when you deal with alien abduction, you got to deal with the whole subjective-objective issue. I mean, Rick Strassman was able to recreate some level of UFO abduction experiences while the person's laying there on DMT.
Yep.
So obviously that was a subjective experience, but, you know, people like Whitley Strieber have had, you know, guests over who all witnessed the same thing when these entities have appeared.
Yeah, I don't know. I just, people bring up odd things that seem to fit the scenarios under these certain circumstances.
Oh, it could very well all be connected. It may not be the exact same thing, but it could all be connected somehow. It could, and I think, you know, the more I read your stuff, the more I feel like we're missing something. It's not just something that we already understand, that we just have to put the puzzle pieces together right. We don't have all the pieces.
Well, you know, there's a lot of people out there that think that this is all just crap. That,
of course.
And we've talked about this before, that if you don't have the background, you haven't laid out that map of how we got from point A to today where we are and maybe point P, if you don't understand that roadmap and how we got there, then it's hard to believe that there is something that ties all of this together. And it's so vast in its numbers that you can't say it's mere coincidence.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And the fact that it's not, oh, how can I put this? It's not every missing person's case.
No.
Very specific types of people that have these scenarios happen to them.
Correct.
Let's move on to William Hurley. We mentioned this briefly with the cell phone earlier, but I thought this was another case that shows you how quickly some of these people disappear.
And it's lightning fast. Another straight arrow guy, William Hurley, 24 years old. His buddies called him Will. October 8, 2009 in downtown Boston at 8:30 p.m. His nickname was Mr. Reliable, Never Late. He was raised in Nashville, North Carolina, joined the Navy out of high school. He was mostly stationed in Florida. The military group he was with went to Boston on a St. Patrick's Day, and it turned out when he was on leave, he met his girlfriend, kind of the love of his life, a girl named Claire Mahoney, and they lived together in Quincy, Mass. Well, on October 8th, Will woke up at 4:30, and he was a groundskeeper at the Westin Country Club, and drove into work, and his buddy at the time, Brendan Venti, they were just both best buddies. And Brendan invited William to go to the country club. To go to the Bruins game that night and watch the Ducks play. And he said, sure, I'll go. And they went down there. And at the end of the first period, William got tired and told Brendan that he had to leave. And again, here we go, separation. Somebody's tired. Somebody doesn't feel well. And he leaves, and he tells Brendan that he's going to call Claire and get a ride home. So as he's walking out, he calls Claire, and Claire says, okay, I'll drive down there to the arena. When Claire's two blocks away, she calls him and asks for the exact location where he's at. And William asks somebody nearby, and she hears him yell back, 99 Nashua Street. And she goes, oh, I know exactly where that is. I'm just around the corner. And he says, hey, I think my phone's going to die, and it goes dead. She turns the corner a minute later onto the location where he's supposed to be, and she doesn't see him. So she drives up to the front, gets out by the arena, starts walking around, doesn't see anything, honks the horn, yells, looks around for an hour, gives up, drives home, and calls Boston and Quincy Police Department. And she's told that she has to wait 24 hours before she can report Will is missing. Following days, he doesn't come home. She calls him incessantly, nothing. Files a missing person report. Well, Monday, Boston PD puts two boats in the water where these rivers are right next to the arena, looking for anything. Well, the police department informs her that they confirmed that they found his cell phone smashed into a million pieces, and they confirmed it was his, but didn't say where they found it. And they said they still hadn't found anything else other than the smashed up phone. Well, friends and family were interviewed and said that what happened is stunningly out of character. That was the quote. 6 days after he disappears, on October 14th, Boston police is on routine patrol near the Suffolk County Jail on Nashua Street, very near the arena, and they see something in the water. William's body is recovered 25 feet from shore, and his wallet and his keys are on his body. The district attorney gives an interview and says that William was found in the water, and we believe he was in the water for a couple of days. He was missing for 5 days and 6 hours. Well, the important part to me in this is that they couldn't determine the cause of death. He's in the water for only a couple days out of the 5 days, 6 hours he's gone. It's a consistency where the cell phone goes dead in relationship to his disappearance. And mm-hmm. there's a relationship there where he's tired and tells people he has to leave that makes him in that position of almost susceptibility.
It seems like these people are literally targeted.
And, you know, on the trail, I've told people before in the other Missing 411 books, there's almost like something's watching you, an opportunity knocks, and you're gone.
Yeah. Yeah. So in a bunch of these cases, these people are supposedly in the water for quite a while, yet their wallets are still found in their pants, and that's kind of unusual, isn't it?
I find it really, really unusual in some of these cases where the water's moving fast and there's this tumbling effect, and your keys and your wallet are still on you. I mean, that's unbelievable, which either goes to the point that they're not in that location very long, or they're put in a position where somebody, something wants you to know who that person is.
Yeah. It's almost like something is picking certain people, doing whatever it's doing with them, and then putting them back, you know, dead from whatever, but not, you know, but kind of like, okay, here's the person you were looking for. And they put them back right where people were already looking.
Yeah, to ensure that you're found and to ensure that you're going to be identified.
Yeah. And what is the oldest case in this book?
Oh, I think it might have been the case in New York where a girl from India disappeared.
Ah, yes, okay. That was like 1928 or so?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so... And most of these cases are men, too, by the way.
Yes, most of them are, but there's a couple of female cases that are right on for that profile hit.
Yeah. So you have one. You have 1928. You have one in 1944. But the majority of them happen later.
Yeah, and I'm not sure if that's because I'm inept at finding these archived cases, or maybe, and I think this is the case, that back 20, 30 years ago, if somebody drowned, or presumed to drown, didn't make a lot of press.
Mm.
There wasn't a lot written about it, because it's not a crime.
Right.
And so I think many times even the press overlooked it and wouldn't even write anything about it. Or if they did write something, it was a 2 or 3 line sentence about so-and-so was found in the river drowned.
Right, right. Because they wouldn't have thought, until recently, nobody looked at these as being unusual.
And it wasn't until recently that we had the advanced forensic capabilities to do toxicology at the level we can today.
True, true. Now, in the case of Alexander Grant, we have some very odd behavior from him that was actually caught on camera after he more or less disappeared. Not fully disappeared, but on his way to disappearing.
Very true. And, you know, we've talked about these kids that stellar people, straight arrows, not troublemakers, great judgment, had a rounded out life, that they did things voluntarily. They were just the wholesome people you'd want living next door to you, and Alexander Grant was one of those. March 6, 2011, 2:11 a.m., Saratoga Springs, New York. Well, Alexander graduated from Briarcliff High School in New York in 2009. He was recognized for his special ability in music. He won a regional talent prize by Intel on a talent search. He enrolled in Boston College, majored in economics, and for 3 years interned at a financial advisory firm while he was going to school full-time. He donated his time to Meals on Wheels, the Robin Hood Foundation, Doctors Without Borders. Again, he's one of these guys that just wanted to do the right thing. And he played keyboard in a band called the Jays. Well, Saratoga Springs, about 15 miles northwest of Bennington, Vermont, which to me is interesting because Bennington is another geographical cluster area of a large magnitude that I've written about in books. On March 5th, 2011, Alexander drove to Saratoga Springs to visit a friend that was attending Skidmore College, a guy named Mike Perlo. He picked up Michael and they drove into the dorms at about 8:30 at night. They hung out, they drank beer at a dorm. At 10:30, they boarded a bus and went downtown. Now, I put that in the book because this goes to the integrity of the people. They didn't want to drive drunk. They took a bus downtown. Good judgment.
Right.
And they were dropped at Van Damme and Clinton Streets. They walked to a party at 146 Church Street, and he was last seen dancing with a female at sometime between 11 and 11:30. He was then seen walking to another area of the house, and that's the last time he was seen by anybody at the party. The police ended up breaking up the party at about 12:30. Friends sent him text messages to Alexander at 1:37, and at noon the following day, he never answered him. Well, Alexander had planned to spend the night with friends the night he disappeared, and his friend said his disappearance was completely and totally out of character for the type of person he was. Now, police get told of his disappearance. They do an investigation. Well, the next morning, there's closed-circuit television that shows somebody walking near the station lane, not far from the house at 11:30 at night. And he's seen on West Avenue staggering in front of a building. Then he walked out behind the building, and he was near some railroad tracks, and he was last seen on closed-circuit at 11:34, and then he's not seen for 2 hours anywhere in the city. At 1:30 a.m., CCTV catches him kicking in a window at a small office building. He squeezes through the window and he cuts himself. At the time, he's wearing one sock, no shoes, long sleeve shirt, and shorts. He's not wearing a coat, he's not wearing long pants, he's not wearing shoes, and he's not wearing his other sock. This is after he wasn't seen anywhere for 2 hours. He cut himself entering the building, and he acted somewhat disoriented or intoxicated. Now, he's seen leaving that building about 45 minutes later near 215, and he's alive. And at about this time, freezing snow and rain are hitting the area. I want everyone to stop at this point and say, the guy has been in a warm building for 45 minutes. Chances are, he's got a little bit more sober, and for sure, the hypothermia is starting to leave the body. So any rational way or reason to leave the building isn't there. He might as well just stay. But he was bleeding pretty good. So freezing snow and rain are hitting the area at about the time he crawls back through the window. He's not seen again. Saratoga Springs police get called the next day by the office building owners about the break-in. And they put the missing person and the break-in together, and they start looking around for more blood, but the rain had washed a lot of this blood away. So he was reported as a missing person, and the police and fire department start searching that area within a half mile of the building. They find his pants and his wallet on a snowbank between Carroll Lane and the railroad tracks where he was seen during that two-hour period, or before the two-hour period. They searched the creek visually, and they searched for 2 days. The end of the second day, the fire department finds his body in 4 feet of water submerged and held in by tree branches. He's 30 feet from the footprints that they had seen, and he's 1 mile from the house party. The coroner determined that he drowned with his blood alcohol level originally reported at 0.11, later retested at 0.16. People need to remember that Alexander could have stood up in that creek. It was so shallow. And the ridiculous nature of him being in this creek when he could have walked across it easily isn't lost on many people. Now, the district attorney made a statement, and when his blood alcohol was 0.1, they said that the meager 0.11% blood alcohol content raises more questions than answers, the district attorney conceded, adding that we still don't know what affected his body to such a significant degree, which then led to the circumstances that caused his death. What they were saying is, this doesn't make sense. His cell phone and his shoes were never found.
And many of these disappearances do come in clusters, too, just like you were finding in the national parks.
Absolutely. On the back of the book, there's a map, and in the map, you can see the clustering effect.
In this case, though, the fact that he's seen with one sock on and all kinds of essentially messed up breaking into the office is definitely the odd thing out in this case. We don't have that in any other case, do you?
No.
Which makes you, it really makes you wonder what happened. Like, did he get away from whoever grabbed him and then they grabbed him again?
Right.
And again, why didn't he stay in the office?
That's the million-dollar question. You have these incidents where it appears as though they're pulled out somehow.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like, they're just snatched up. I think in the book you compare it to, one of those toy grab machines.
And I got to give that credit to my son. He just graduated college. He knows the stories. And he says, Dad, it's like that analogy where you're at an arcade and you have this machine that you try to drop over something. You pick it up into the claw, and then you move it across the machine and you drop it into another location. And he says, that's kind of what it reminds me of.
Yeah. But what could do that is the bigger question.
Can you tell me?
I wish I could. I know, as you said, some people have suggested, aliens. The problem I have with that is that we don't even know if aliens exist.
Yeah.
If we had some proof that there were aliens, I'm sure there are people who argue with that statement and say we have proof, but we don't actually have proof that aliens exist. We have proof there are UFOs, but we don't have proof exactly what they are. And when you connect this to whatchamacallit's work on the abduction experience, Mac, you also see connections to the fairy faith and such and folklore and the way they would take people. And that also gets connected into the UFO phenomena by people like John Keel and Jacques Vallée.
Correct.
So this may be all connected in some weird way, but we may be seeing different parts of it. And we're also going to get into, in the second part, I think we'll get into a little bit of the connections to cattle mutilation, which also get kind of tied into all of this.
Well, one of the things that several people who have read these books tell me is that, Dave, like the example of the men or these college young men that get dropped in the river, there's intentions there that we want, somebody wants us to find them.
Yeah.
Because those bodies could be dumped in the middle of the woods. They could be buried. If they have the ability to take somebody in the middle of a town when we don't see them, then they have the ability to put the person in the middle of the Atlantic and we'll never find them. But they don't.
Right.
They put them someplace where we will find them. And when I talk about the unusual nature of the body in the water, bodies protruding, bodies floating face up when they shouldn't be, coroners being unable to determine the cause of death time after time after time with these cases. Well, in my mind, I'm always wondering, so if they were taken and somebody is using them, what are they using them for?
Yes, because they don't seem to be harmed in any way necessarily.
Harm that we understand.
Right. I mean, they're not coming back with obvious physical damage except for in a handful of cases.
Right.
So what's the purpose behind it?
Well, you know, one of the things that that I keep saying over and over again is that, and I don't mind saying it because the guy deserves to have credit, but Kevin Gannon really did a job in determining that these things are occurring and that people have been ignoring it for a long, long time. And I, unfortunately, you know, his work wasn't picked up the way it should be. But I'll read this statement that he made, and I think it is so on key for what's been happening in the Missing 411 books I read before and these in this book. He made this statement. They're talking about the suspects. They cannot be touched. They cannot be caught. They are superior. This is the collective mentality of an organization of killers. The victims represent cases that can be linked not by association to the same killers, but rather by association to the same ideology and purpose to their murders.
Yeah, but that doesn't explain how the people are disappearing.
No, but what I think is interesting is that when you take that statement from Gannon, when he had never heard about our work,
right,
it's easily transferable.
Absolutely, absolutely. As you said, it's a perfect predator because it's never been caught.
Right. It's never hiccuped. We've never had a real inkling to what's going on.
You know, and maybe this last case where he was running around, you know, breaking into the office, maybe he almost got away.
Yeah, and, you know, the unfortunate part of that is that the ones that do survive don't have a memory which matches what I've written about in the other books.
Yeah, yeah. And that makes you wonder if the memory is being wiped somehow or if they're experiencing something that their brain doesn't quite click with. I mean, like a dream happens in an altered state, and some people don't remember any of their dreams because they happen in that altered state.
Correct.
So if something is happening around them that they can't quite process, maybe that's part of the reason they can't remember it when they come back. It just gets kind of blocked out.
Yep, I agree.
And right there is where we're going to stop with part one of this interview with David Politis. We'll have next week part two. And if you want to pick up David's books, don't try to buy these on Amazon. None of the Missing 411 books are on Amazon officially. So you will pay an arm and a leg from people reselling them on Amazon. Go to David's website, canammissing.com, as in CanadianAmericanMissing.com. The books are only $24.95. And if you're paying more than that, you're getting ripped off. And we're going to take you out with some Sax Mile, Saxmyle. This is a song called A Jealousy. In Cherokee, it means my grandma. See you next week.
It's It's my restlessness that brings me here again. Each time I'll come out a little farther. The family's used to it by now, I suppose. And Grandma stopped her teasing. Sure, when I was younger, with all that talk of the boogeyman. But who could blame a five-year-old with all the dried gourds and that creaky windmill? I guess it didn't do anything but make me want to come out and see for myself. It's just so looming. I've covered every square inch of this place at some point or another. Yeah, and over there behind that tree line is the Crawford's Pond. It's just that as that sun goes down behind those trees, it's like a change comes over everything. During harvest and into winter, each night I'll excuse myself from the table, throw on my jacket, and head out into the middle of this field. And with each step, I'll recall the things Grandma used to say to herself when she was working in the garden or maybe putting us kids to bed. Didn't make much sense at the time. She'd say, nine times will the cats play, and after that they'll have gone away. Bear the watcher and the sage. Dark as night when moon glow, come the smell of fall I know. Mind the specter and the sage. Used to sound creepy, but now I know what you meant. And maybe now she knows the mystery.